Thank you, Fox. I'm glad he said that, because it won't take you long to find out that I'm having a little trouble with my throat. But I would have been nervous anyway, so that's as it is. My name is Viv Engel, and I am from Monk's Corner, South Carolina. And I'd like to have a word or two to say about this name proposition. My heart actually bled last night when Barney said they named him Carol. Well, for his benefit, they named me Vivian. So move over, Barney. We'll join him. Another thing that is rather singular. I don't know of any fellowship, of any organization, of any movement under heaven, judging from what I've heard here before from Chuck and from Barney last night and from myself, that you would sit calmly and listen very calmly to three fugitives from a funny farm. I'm one of them, too. I don't think you could get any group together at all that would do that. And so I am grateful this morning to have a part in this program, and I ask your indulgence as I try to speak because of this laryngitis. I was hopeful that it would have been cleared up this morning. I talked to several people, and each one of them gave me their favorite remedy. I tried them all and got worse by the hour. So I don't know what the end is going to be in this thing. That was a beautiful tribute that we just heard from Virgil about Bill. And I think it's well for us to consider this morning, consider consciously some of Bill's thoughts that have been passed on to us. He has held up a mirror to us, actually, in the big book, of which he was the author, of course, in which he told us what we were. And he told us what we could do about it. And he told us what we could expect if we did something about it. And so, in the beginning, I would like to read just what he said about us. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovered control. All of us felt at times that we were gaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control and led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and we became convinced that we are in the grip of a progressive illness. That gave comfort to a lot of us in the beginning. And in the beginning, in my beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I understood what he was talking about, because my first book was the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read it, and I thought I understood it. Recently, I've been reading it again, the second edition of the book, and I find so many things that I had missed before. In the beginning, we were told, or at least I was told, and I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to do what the old-timers told me to do. I wanted to do it their way. And there were one or two well-used propositions that cropped up there that bugged me a great deal. And one of them was that there are no musts in AA. Another one was that you could be selective in the 12 steps, that you just pick out what you want. I think the term used back that time was cafeteria style. Just pick out what appeals to you and let the rest take care of themselves. But there were musts in AA for me. There are still musts in AA for me. And I think there always shall be. And I think that that's one of the greatest forces in my maintaining my sobriety. I must admit that I'm an alcoholic. I must admit that I'm powerless over alcohol. And may I say here that I'm not evangelizing. I'm not trying to change your minds about how you shall operate your program in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm speaking to you as a friend, visiting friends, and speaking solely for myself this morning. And those must involve decisions, circumstances, choices. And you know, one of the greatest gifts that God has given to man is choice. No, there is no compelling force used by Alcoholics Anonymous that tells me that that I've got to do any one particular thing. But they do give me a choice. They give me a choice of selecting the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as a vehicle by which I may assure my sobriety, my abstinence in the beginning, and that by practicing the principles that you've just heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I may grow, that I may mature in a relationship to my fellow man and to the God of my understanding. These are the things that Bill has taught us. These are the things that echo down through the corridors of time this morning. These are the things that our co-founder, our beloved co-founder, left with us as a precious legacy. And you know, as Virgil pointed out, Bill himself refused to break his own anonymity, however famous he may have become because of this philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. But death broke it 3 weeks ago and established for all time his celestial identity. And for that, we're so grateful this morning. We're so grateful this morning. Maybe I'll be a little personal here, and it was my privilege to be in New York at one time and to know Bill very briefly. Pardon me. And as one early in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, I suppose in looking back, and I think this is true, that I wanted to impress this great man. That he had meant so much, his teachings had meant so much to me. And so it was my privilege to sit at a table at dinner one night with him, and I wanted to show him that I knew a little bit about this thing. I wanted to show him, and I said something about this new philosophy. I couldn't have said a worse thing, because Bill hit the ceiling. And he says, "Viv, I want you, when you go to your room tonight, I think you'll find a Gideon Bible there. I want you to turn to such and such a book, such and such a chapter, and begin with such and such a verse." He had it all mapped out. "I want you to read that, and let's meet at breakfast tomorrow morning. And I want you to tell me what's new about this thing. I want you just to explain just what's new about this thing." Well, you can well imagine it was a very humble Viv Engel who went to breakfast the next morning, because I had read the night before the Sermon on the Mount, which was the basis for Bill's great philosophy that he framed for us, that we might enjoy such things as this morning. And so it is my privilege, as we speak here this morning, not to try to change your mind about this thing, but to point out that for Viv Engel there's some must in the practice of the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we speak in the beginning of admitting that we were powerless over alcohol. And that's true, and that's as it should be. But I believe, as we contemplate a little bit about this thing, that we arrive that there's a little bit of difference between admitting and accepting. You know, for quite a long time, I admitted many things. I was one of the admittingest persons you ever saw when I first came into AA. I shall never forget the first meeting that I attended. I went, it was some 30 days after coming out of one of these drying out emporiums that I searched for AA. I suppose time I felt was running out. I don't think I was going to die, but I thought that I was to be destined to continue in the area of alcoholism. I didn't know what it was, but continue in the area of drinking as long as I lived. And so it was on a Sunday afternoon that I went to Charleston and sought AA. Now, like some of the others, I was not sent. I searched for it. And I found it. I found a little club room on a side street in Charleston, South Carolina, next door to a bar. And that was the AA club room. There was a door between the AA club room and the bar. I don't know whether you know much about Charleston, South Carolina or not, but bars in Charleston did not observe Sundays. They just operated as best they could under the cover of Sunday. But the bartender at that place was one of the greatest friends of Alcoholics Anonymous you ever saw. If you were identified with Alcoholics Anonymous, you didn't get a drink at his bar for love or money. He refused to serve. And he'd answer the phone if there was nobody there. And he'd call you and say, there's some guy in trouble out here somewhere. There was one man in there, and I began asking questions. And finally he said, listen here, fellow, said, I haven't been around this thing too long either. And I can't answer so many questions, but Thursday night they're meeting up at the old Citadel building, and there'll be some old-timers there, and they can answer the questions for you. Well, I went home, and I prepared myself for this Thursday night meeting. I don't know where I got the idea about AA at that particular time. Yes, I guess I do, because I'm the son of a preacher man, and I was reared in the atmosphere that... Barney talked about last night, this environment that produces so many alcoholics. I was reared in that environment. And maybe that was the reason for me expecting something like a revival service when I first went into AA. Well, I went in on a Thursday night and I sat down and I was prepared. I was going to confess. I don't know whether you were going to call it a conversion, but I was going to confess. I was prepared. You name it, and I'd confess to it. Just anything you said, from just a mere offense to rape or murder or anything else. Well, I was ready for it. And so I sat there, and I expected, as the speakers got up and talked, well, here I was offering myself to this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, presenting myself for membership, and I thought I qualified, but they didn't pay a bit of attention to me. I expected every speaker that got up to say, this is one of them things we've been talking about, and point to me, and that was going to be my moment. I was going to rise to the occasion. I suppose that it was the old matter of so many of us, me particularly, had sought the spotlight for so long that we just couldn't be comfortable unless we were in the spotlight. But they continued to pay no attention to me. And I sat there rather miserable because I thought this was an important occasion. But something strange and wonderful did happen. There was a strange warmth there. They didn't pay any attention to me, but I got that feeling that here's where I belong. Here's where I should have been a long time ago. I got that sense of belonging. And I had been isolated from the human race, I thought, for so long. I had erected so many barriers that none who might want to help me could penetrate those barriers. They had to be collapsed from the inside. And I was not capable of collapsing those barriers from the inside. It was at that meeting that this strange feeling of the sense of belonging came upon me. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Oh, I was so new. I was so ignorant, but I was searching. That was the only qualification I had, was the search that I was making at that time. And I continued to search. Oh, I went to all the meetings around that area. And I continued to go to all the meetings around that area for about 3 months, a little short of 3 months. And I see, you know, it happened. I see it on your faces. It really did. I think in looking back that I felt that all this business about an illness of alcoholism and all this sense of not being able to control your drinking, I'd had ample evidence of it, but I'd forgotten it. I began to doubt, I'm quite sure, all these things. And in so doubting, I took a couple of drinks one afternoon and went home and was cheerful at dinner that night. And that should have been a dead giveaway. But May, my wife, who's with me here today, she was tolerant, to say the least. And the boys, they didn't frown so much about it. But anyway, I woke up next morning feeling fine, back to work, all full of whimwigger and vitality, as they say in the Dutch. And I had proven something. I was no alcoholic. I had proven that I could take a drink or leave it alone. How often have we heard that thing? So, the next afternoon, I suppose that it was that feeling, if a little do a little good, a lot ought to do a lot of good. So I increased it. 3 days later, I was dragged in to a drying out emporium, and I mean literally dragged in. That's the way they always got me there. You could take a fifth of liquor and lead me all over the southeast, but you couldn't get me in there any other way. And so it was that I came again into a realization that I was powerless over alcohol. I'm grateful to say that I haven't had a drink since. I don't wish this at all, but I know that if it had been left to me, that there would have been many drinks and many drunks since that time. But I think the good Lord of us all saw that here was an egotistical little individual who needed cutting down to size. And I don't think that God imposes a drunk on us, but I think sometimes He permits it to teach us things that we could not otherwise learn. And so it was with me. I learned. I learned indeed that alone I could not achieve even abstinence, to say nothing of sobriety. And so from that time on, AA has indeed been my life. It has been a life of thrill, of adventure, of fellowship, of love. It's been a life that I had dreamed about. You know, as youngsters, that we dream about how we're going to conquer the world. I'm from the mountain country, and up in the western part of North Carolina, originally, as I told you, my father was a minister, and we lived all over that mountain country up there. He was a Methodist minister, and he kept us on the move. And so when I went into work, I left the university at Chapel Hill and went into newspaper work, in which I I couldn't say I served. I worked for a good many years in newspaper work, and I suppose that it was the feeling that a good newspaper man had to drink, and I wanted to be a good newspaper man. And so I drank, and I felt that it was part of the profession. I had some pretty good opportunities with the daily papers and at one time with the press service, and I felt that a good newspaper man just had to drink. I suppose I'd seen too many movies like The Front Page and things like that, where the star reporter had his bottle by his side as he wrote. Well, I kept mine in the desk, but it was there. And sometimes I wonder just what happened in those times, because I have actually opened the newspaper the next morning and read with complete amazement stories that I had written about things I didn't even remember about the night before. Some power guides us, I'm quite sure, at times like this. And so through the career of newspaper writing, and I came to the low country, and I really got hooked two ways down there. I didn't admit it at the time, but I got hooked on alcohol. I also got hooked on matrimony. And so that's a combination, you know, that it's rather productive in the low country of South Carolina. I don't know how it is in your part of the country at all. But we have found a good life together. May's in Al-Anon, very active in Al-Anon. Our boys are not our teens anymore, but they never were, but they were teens at one time. But they've gone, and so many wonderful things have happened to us since that time. Things like this. And here let me pause for a moment to say that I'm so grateful to those who were responsible for permitting us to come over and participate in this fellowship. It's been wonderful for me. It's been enjoyable up to now. Up to now. It's been thoroughly enjoyable. And I've met so many of you for the first time, and I've seen a good many old friends. And it seems to me like that in these fellowships that we have, these retreats, they call it, that we have, that there's a new dimension of AA there. Oh, it's wonderful at the local level. Of course it is. The state level, the regional level, even the national level. But there's a new dimension in the retreat philosophy in which the spiritual is emphasized to so great a degree. I remember reading in our literature one time that we rely on the spiritual simply because so many of us can't get along without it. And I think that's the position that I find myself in this morning. You know, this matter of faith enters into this thing, and I think that whenever we look back upon our ourselves, our lives as alcoholics, and it is not too beneficial for me to look back too often and brood about it. There are a lot of things that I need to forget about my life as an alcoholic. Some things I need to remember. I shouldn't forget the jails. I shouldn't forget the asylum. I shouldn't forget that the things that happened at one time can happen again. Now, please, I use the word asylum, and that's almost taboo. They call it up in our country a state hospital. Very kind to us. But don't get uneasy, please. I've got papers. I don't know whether the others who spoke to you about it or not, but I've got papers to prove my sanity. I don't know whether the others can do it or not, so I can prove it to you today. Don't ask me to produce them, but I've got them just the same, and I treasure them very highly. You know, they tell us in Alcoholics Anonymous, those who are mature, and those in the old days had told me that there were no musts in AA. And then again, they told me, you got to do it this way. And that bothered me a great deal, because I couldn't do it their way. If I tried to do it their way, I tripped myself up so often. And I learned as time went along, I hope I learned permanently as time went along, that I had to do it my way, that I had to respond to the opportunity that you have given, depending upon my capacity to respond. I had to do it my way. I had to turn to the God of my understanding, and that opens so many doors and so many windows. That phrase, God of my understanding. I sat on the back seat at an AA meeting one time by the side of an old seafaring man. He had been all over the world and traveled the seven seas, and he was a great guy. He was ignorant as all get out when it came to culture and things like that, but he was wise, so wise. And he saw me kind of squirming, I suppose, sitting there listening to those who talked. And finally he leaned over to me and said, "Say, Bud," and that did me good because I was just as old as he was. And when he called me Bud, that made me feel real good. He said, "Why don't you turn to your own God? To your own God." And you know what I had been doing all this time? I had been reaching and searching and failing to reach the God of somebody else's understanding. I was borrowing somebody else's God. And that somehow didn't work for me. But when this old seafaring man had said to me, "Your God, the God of your understanding, because he understands you," he said. And how wise he was. How wise he was. And so there was the beginning of Viv Engel's response to the offer of the God of his understanding, who had been standing by so long, waiting for the opportunity to help. And he did help. He helped so much. Some of us call this faith. Some of us call this faith. And in the faith that the God of our understanding understands us and opens his arms to us, however frail we may be, however weak we may be, that we can stand upon our own feet and walk with him through life, I think that there's nothing more wonderful in the world. And sometimes in moments of almost ecstasy that I'm sure we all have, that close relationship with God, sometimes I think, how fortunate that we, who are alcoholics, how fortunate we are as alcoholics. I'll tell you a story about that. It was my privilege one time to be speaking in a town in which there was a judge in the audience. And I frailed the air and tried to practice what my father told me one time. He says, if you haven't got anything to say, just yell like hell. But I didn't have much to say, and I was yelling pretty well. My voice was better at that time. But after the meeting, this judge came down and said, "I wish I were an alcoholic." Well, now that proves that I didn't have much to say for a man to respond that way, to wish he were an alcoholic. And I thought the fellow had blown his cork. I didn't know what had happened to this man. Here a judge comes down, and I looked at him in amazement, and he said, I know. He said, "I want to tell you about it." I said, "I was reared in this town, went to school in this town. I wasn't a sissy. I was a reasonably good boy. They didn't consider me a juvenile delinquent. I lived a fairly normal life. I did things that most boys do. I went to Sunday school and church and things like that. And I did all right. And said I went away to school, and in law school, my class elected me president of the class. And I was favored a great deal, and said I came back to my people, and after the practice of law for a while, they elected me a judge. And he said, my life has been one of those even lives like that. I said, go on, because I was interested here. He said, by the very fact that you have been down in the morass, in the swamplands of life, that you have been given the capacity to reach peaks that I can only dream about. That I can only dream about. Oh, he said, you're an emotional bunch. Sure you are. And in that emotion is your strength. And I can't help but envy your capacity to reach the peaks of a relationship with the God that you've been talking about tonight. That I can only dream about. Oh, I think I know God. But he says, I think you're closer to him than I can be, simply because you've been so far away from him for so long. And so he had something there, I thought. He had something that I feel that we all need, and that is a gratitude. Not because that we were alcoholic or are alcoholic, but simply because through this medium of agony and suffering that we have come to know in a deeply personal way a God that we can understand. Not a borrowed God that the ministers have described so eloquently from their pulpits. Not a God that a good friend has told us about that has meant so much to him. But a God that we can turn to in agony perhaps, in ecstasy perhaps, in moments of quietude, in moments of despair and desolation. And we have them. We have them. Barney will pardon me. I'm going to defend the psychiatrist here for a moment. Because I went that route too. And one of them just made things perfect for me. He didn't do a thing for me about my alcoholism. But he was talking to me one day and he called me Mr. Wasn't that wonderful? He said, Mr. Engel, your trouble is not alcohol at all. It's depression. You get depressed and you drink. Says, what we needed to do is to correct your depression. So if you didn't become depressed, you wouldn't drink. Well, that came on me like a radiant light. I didn't quit drinking, but I became more frequently depressed because that gave me what I needed. Just press a button and get depressed so you could drink. Now, in this environment that we were talking about, being reared in a parsonage, and it was taboo. Liquor was taboo. To my dad, it was a sin. I cannot accept that it is a sin. I can accept this, that we do a lot of sinful things when we're drinking, but I just couldn't accept that I was condemned as a sinner because I took a drink. But because of my behavior after taking a drink, that was a different thing entirely. And so, in that environment, I was reared feeling guilty about alcohol. I was 23 years old before I had my first drink. And don't ever let anybody tell you it takes 10 or 12 years to become an alcoholic. It didn't take me very long. It took me a long time to recognize it and to admit it. But it happened very rapidly with me. But I always had to have a reason. I always had to have some reason to take a drink. Any reason, it doesn't matter, but I had to satisfy myself. And some of the reasons that I could pull out of thin air were the most ridiculous things that you can consider. But they satisfied me. I had to have the satisfaction of giving myself a reason for taking a drink. How stupid can we be? And so it seems to me this morning that we of all people are so blessed. The name business again. You know, it's rather ridiculous. I just hadn't think of this. It's rather ridiculous. When I came in to register here at this very elegant place, I went to the registration desk and I said, I think I have reservations here. My name is Engel, and the clerk insisted on calling me Isaac. Now, I'm not a son of Abraham. And so I said, my name's Engel, and he still called me Isaac. So if there's no Engel registered at the desk and anyone should like to get in touch with us, call for Isaac. I think that you'll find that'll work so far. So this thing that we're talking about, our sobriety, is a maturing thing. It's a progressive thing, just as progressive as the illness of alcoholism was. It's abstinence, yes, upon which we build sobriety, the way of life that Alcoholics Anonymous talks about. Sobriety, yes. The 12 steps, yes. I've used this before, but I like it. I think it says something to me, and I'm not being particularly biblical here, but whenever I think of the 12 steps, I think of the wanderings of the Israelites so many years ago. The pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night. Moving ahead, but beckoning always to come toward it. To me, those are the 12 steps of AA, all the 12 steps of AA. They cannot for me be selective. I must abandon myself totally and completely. There's no option here. I must abandon myself to the 12 steps of AA. And in so abandoning myself, I find this way of life of which we have talked, of which you have lived, and which you have taught me about. I know of only one way to capture this new life that we are talking about, living it to its fullest degree, because I think to every person there opens a gateway that leads to comfortable living, yes, to satisfying living, yes, but leads, most important of all, to our relationship with a power so tremendous it can change our very lives and sometimes can change the environment in which we live, can change the entire course of life. Power that comes with inner honesty, because in inner honesty, then we face ourselves. We accept ourselves. We confront ourselves. And in so doing, we see ourselves as we really are, not as once we were, not as we hope to be, but as we are at that moment of confrontation. And sometimes this is a shocking experience. Very often it is. It was with me. But it is a necessary experience, because in this inner honesty of which we speak, I think that we can live in the words of the ancient prayer, that it can support us all day long. And as the ancient prayer reads, till the shadows lengthen and evening comes and the busy world is hushed and the fever of life is over. And this, to me, is inner honesty, a rare and precious gift from heaven itself, inner honesty. And it is in this attitude, it is here, I think, that we shall discover indeed the strength of surrender and the grandeur of hope, the splendor of love, and the wonder of God. This, my friends, is AA at its finest. It's the majesty and the glory of it all. Thank you, and God bless you.